We're going to start from the bottom of Kuf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, two lines from the bottom. Okay, so the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Pamotos Shel Beis Rebbe Mutter L'Taltalan B'Shabbos. There were these candles or these lamps in the house of Rebbe, so the Gemara says that those were permitted to be carried on Shabbos. So Amar Le Rabbi Zera, B'Nitalin B'Yado Achas, O V'Shtei Yadayim. Rabbi Zera raised the question, what kind of lamps or candles were these? Were they small enough that they could be carried with one hand? Or were they so large that they needed two hands to be carried? So the Gemara says, Amar Le, Ka'osan Shel Beis Avicha, just like the lamps and the candles in your father's house, which apparently were very small, those are permissible to carry on Shabbos, but the lamps that are much larger that require two hands to move, those you would not be allowed to move on Shabbos. V'amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Kronos Shel Beis Rebbe Mutter L'Taltalan B'Shabbos. Similarly, the Gemara says if you have these wagons in the house of Rebbe that, again, were made for people to ride in to use, those were allowed to be carried on Shabbos. So Amar Le Rabbi Zera, the Rabbi Zera raises the same question. B'nitolin ba'adam echad o v'shnei b'nei adam. Are we talking about a wagon that is so light that one person could carry it? Or is it heavy enough that it requires two people? So the Gemara says, Amar Le, ka'osan shel beis avicha. In other words, the same answer. Just like in your father's house, the wagons were much smaller, those are the types of wagons that are permissible to carry, but the ones that are much larger are going to be problematic. And then finally, the Gemara says, V'amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Heter Lohem Rabbi Chanina Leves Rebbe, Lishtos Yayin Bekronos Shal Nachri Bechosam Echad. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Chanina permitted the people in the house of Rabbi Huda Hanasi to drink wine out of a flask of a non-Jew as long as there was one seal on the flask. We know that if a non-Jew handles wine, so we know that Bazman Azeh, it's an Isra Durabbanan of Stam Yenam. Bazman Gemara, there could have potentially been Isra Durais of Yayin Nesach. There was a concern that the wine might have been poured for Avodah Zarah. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Chanina said, as long as there's a single seal that you see was never tampered with, that's good enough. That's a good enough assumption that the non-Jew did not touch the wine. So the Gemara explains, V'lo yadana imishum desavar la kerab Eliezer imishum imsa devein asiyah. The problem was, the thing here that was unclear is why did Rabbi Chanina allow this? So one option is to say he allowed this because he was following in the footsteps of the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, which is cited in the Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah, where Rabbi Eliezer says that all you need in order to, in order for us to be certain that no non-Jew tampered with the wine, is simply to have one seal. According to Rabbi Eliezer, one seal is sufficient. So that's one option, that either Rabbi Chanina really held like Rabbi Eliezer. The other option is maybe no. Maybe Rabbi Chanina generally holds that you need to have a double seal in order for us to be certain that a non-Jew did not tamper with the wine. So how come over here Rabbi Chanina was allowing the wine from Rebbe's house to, he assumed the wine was kosher as long as there was a single seal? So the Gemara says that could have been because of Eimsa Devein Asiyah, because the fear that the non-Jews had of the house of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the Nasi, as his name implies. He was the head of the Jewish people, and he had a lot of government, he had a lot of connections to the government. So it could be that the non-Jews were too scared to tamper with his wine. But maybe for a regular person who wasn't of that caliber, so it could be that maybe a single seal would not be good enough. So the Gemara kind of leaves that as an unresolved question. Okay. The Mishnah now says, Nachri Shehidlik Esaner, Mishdamish la'oro Yisrael, v'im b'shvil Yisrael aser. So if a non-Jew lights a candle on Shabbos for his own sake, because he wants to, to read or whatever it is, so then a Jew is allowed to benefit from that light. However, if the non-Jew lit the candle for the Jew, and again, we'll see in a second how we know that, so then the Jew is not allowed to benefit. Similarly, mile mayim lahashkos behemto mashka acharav Yisrael, v'im b'shvil Yisrael aser. If a non-Jew goes ahead and draws water from a well on Shabbos, assuming, of course, that the well isn't, let's say, for example, in Rosh Hashanah, right? So he's going to end up carrying the water. So if he does it for himself, and now the Jew wants to kind of, tag along and take some of the water afterwards to feed his animal, if that's okay. But if the non-Jew clearly is drawing water for the Jew, that would be a problem. And then finally, a third similar halacha, Asa Nachri Kevesh Liridbo Yored Acharav Yisrael V'im Bishvil Yisrael Aser. If a non-Jew builds a ramp, again, if he builds it for himself, then the Jew is allowed to go down the ramp. But if he builds it for the Jew, then it's a problem. And the Mishnah says, yeah.
Is the Jew giving instructions.
No. There's no. If a Jew is giving instructions, that's a separate. That's a mira la'akum. That's a separate issue. Here, nothing was being said. But the question is, was it clear that the non-Jew was doing it for the Jew? Again, we'll see in the Gemara how we know whether it's clear. Maybe they're friends. Maybe he was looking at the Jew when he was building it. Or we'll see as we go in the Gemara. So the Mishnah says, Ma'isa b'Rabban Gamliel uzakenim shayu ba'in b'sfina va'asa nachri kevesh liredbo v'yardu bo Rabban Gamliel uzakenim. The Mishnah relates that one time Rabban Gamliel and a bunch of his colleagues were traveling on a boat. There was a non-Jew on the boat who built the ramp on Shabbos. He went down the ramp, and then Rabban Gamliel and all the other people followed him down the ramp. So you see that because the ramp was built for the non-Jew himself, therefore all the Jews were allowed to tag along and go down the ramp. So the Gemara now wants...
Why would we ever think that is not the case?
What do you mean? Why would you think that it's a...
If a non-Jew does something for themselves that we could not...
Okay, it's a good point.
Ourselves.
No, there's no reason why it should be a problem. But really, the chiddush really is the other half of the statement that when he's doing it for a Jew, and again, we'll see. The Gemara is now going to try and figure out why the Mishnah had to list all three of these cases. All three of these cases seem to be saying.
That was my next question.
Yeah, that's going to be the Gemara's question. All these three cases seem to be saying the same thing. So the Gemara says, "Utsricha, we need all three of these cases. De'i ashmiina ner. If we only had the first case of the non-Jew lighting the candle, so I would have said." Because the candle provides the same amount of light for one person or for 100 people. Meaning the assumption is that a non-Jew is not going to go out of his way to light more candles. Again, even though, obviously, if you light more candles, there's going to be more light in the room. But the point is that one candle provides sufficient light for one person as much as for 100 people. However, in the case of drawing water from the well, so if the non-Jew knows that there's a Jew behind him who also wants water for his animals, he's not going to draw one bucket of water. He'll probably draw two buckets of water from the well, right? So that's a problem because he may actually end up doing more malacha for the Jew. On the other hand, the Gemara says, Vekevish Lamali, what about the third case of the ramp? So the Gemara says, Maisa the Rabban Gamliel Luzakanim Kamash Malan. The Gemara says, you're right. The case of the ramp is completely unnecessary. The only reason why the Mishnah even mentions it is just to kind of segue into that story at the end of the Mishnah about Rabban Gamliel and the Zakanim going down the ramp that was built by the non-Jew. Okay. The Gemara says, Tana Rabbana, Nachri Shaliket Asavim, Machil Acha Rav Yisrael, Ve'im Bishvil Yisrael Asher. Again, basically paraphrasing the same concepts that we just saw in the Mishnah. If a non-Jew gathers grass to feed his animals on Shabbos, again, if he does it for himself, then the Jew can take some of the grass and feed his own animals. But if he does it for the Jew, then obviously it's a problem. And then similarly, Mile Mayim Lahashkos Behemto, Mashka Acha Rav Yisrael, Ve'im Bishvil Yisrael Asher. Same idea. If the non-Jew draws water to feed his own animals, so then the Jew could take from the water also. But if he does it for the Jew, then it's a problem. So the Gemara qualifies this. Bamedvar mamurim she'ein makiro. Aval makiro aser. The Gemara says this idea that a Jew can take the water or the grass or the whatever and can use it for his own animals, assuming that the non-Jew didn't do it for him, is only going to be true if him and the non-Jew are not friendly, if they don't know each other, if they're complete strangers, they never met each other before, then there's a pretty high probability that the non-Jew is not doing it for the Jew, again, unless of course we know otherwise. But if they're friendly, the Gemara says, then we have to start to be concerned that maybe the non-Jew was doing it for the Jew in the first place. So before we explain that qualification, the Gemara just kind of has to explain another point here, which is the Gemara says, "Ini, is this whole halacha really true?" The Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Mamid Adam Behemto Agabe Asavim B'Shabes, Avalo Agabe Muktzah B'Shabes. The Gemara says, "Hang on 1 second. Let's say we're talking about a case where I know for a fact that the non-Jew did not take the water or the grass for me; he did it for himself." The Gemara says it should still be a problem to use the water or the grass. Why? The Gemara explains because there is a halacha. The Gemara in Maseches Eruvin says, "I can take my animal on Shabbos and I can put the animal on top of a patch of grass, and I need not be concerned that I'm going to come to start plucking the grass out of the ground, because again, if the animal eats the grass on its own, it's obviously not my problem. That's obviously okay. So the Gemara says I could take my animal, bring him to a whole area of grass, let the animal graze, and I need not be concerned that I'm going to pluck grass out of my own. That's mutter. However, what is not mutter, says the Gemara, is to take my animal and bring it to an area where there are muktza items lying around. Now, again, without getting into too much detail, what exactly that means, rocks or other things
things that are around that I may want to pick up or I may want to give to my animal, the Gemara says that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. So the question is, even if the non-Jew was plucking the grass or was removing the food or whatever for himself, those items by definition are muktzah because they obviously were not set aside before Shabbos because a non-Jew is plucking them out of the ground on Shabbos itself, right? So the Gemara says, even if the non-Jew is doing this only for himself, and I know that for a fact, it should still be a problem. It should still be usur. So the Gemara says, you're right. The Gemara says, you're absolutely right. Really, theoretically, you really are not allowed to feed your animal anything on Shabbos, even if the non-Jew did it for himself. The case that we're talking about here is where you position your animal a little bit farther away from the grass, and you kind of just let the animal roam by itself and eat all the food by itself. But to actually take the animal and physically plop it down in an area of grass that the non-Jew plucked on Shabbos, even if he did it just for himself, the Gemara says is a problem. If you want to let your animal roam free and do its own thing and you're not watching it, that's fine. That's okay on Shabbos. But to actively put your animal in a situation where it's going to be benefiting from something muktzah, even if the non-Jew took it only for himself, is problematic on Shabbos. Okay, so that was the first issue that the Gemara had to address. Now the Gemara... Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. How come we totally discount everything that we learned from yesterday about Nachri Baitik on Shabbos?
Okay, so the Gemara... Okay, so we'll see in a second. The Gemara is gonna not mention that point specifically, but it's gonna mention something similar to that as we'll see in a second. But here the Gemara has a more basic question, a more general issue, which is forget about whether the non-Jew is doing the malacha for himself or for me. Even if he's doing it for himself, it should still be a problem because everything here should be muktzah anyway. And the Gemara says, no, the way to get around that is to position your animal far enough away from the grass where it's just gonna go roaming on its own, and it's not gonna, in other words, it's not going to be an issue of muktzah. But the implication obviously is that if I plot my animal down in a grassy area where the non-Jew plucked the grass even for himself, that would in fact be problematic on Shabbos. That's clearly the implication of this Gemara. Okay, so the Gemara now says, Amar Mar. Bamed varam amurim she'in makiro, ava makiro aser. So we said in the Gemara a little bit earlier that the only time that it's going to be permissible for me to benefit how my animal eat this grass is assuming that the non-Jew and myself are not friendly, we're not on good terms, or we just don't know each other. But if we're friendly, so the Gemara says that's a problem because we're assuming that the non-Jew is probably doing the malacha for me. So the Gemara says, but hang on a second. Ha Rabban Gamliel makiro hava. Rabban Gamliel was friends with this non-Jew. How do we know that he was friends with the non-Jew? So Rashi says, because the fact they were traveling on the same boat together probably means that they were friendly. Again, I don't know if that's like a, you know, the greatest proof in the world, but that's what Rashi assumes. So again, assuming that Rabban Gamliel and this non-Jew were friendly with each other, so that's a problem. How was he allowed to go down the ramp? So the Gemara gives two answers. The Gemara says, Amar Abaye, Shalom Befanav Ava. Abaye says that the only reason why it was mutter for Rabban Gamliel to go down the ramp was because when the non-Jew built the ramp, Rabban Gamliel wasn't there. He was, I don't know, he was somewhere else on the boat. He was doing something else. So clearly, the non-Jew built it without having him in mind. That's why it was mutter. Rava, Amar Rava says, no. Afilu Tema Befanav, Ner Lecha, Ner Lemeya. Rava says, even if Rabban Gamliel was standing right there when he built the ramp, it would still be mutter for him to go down. Why? So Rava says, because of the principle that we cited in the beginning of this Gemara, ner le'echa ner le'me, meaning the same way that one candle provides, you know, sufficient light for 100 people as much as for one person, so too the ramp, again, it's the same ramp. It's not like the non-Jew is gonna build extensions to the ramp if more people are going down. And he's gonna build the same ramp if it's just him going down or if it's 50 people going down. So because of that principle, according to Rava, that's why it would be mutter for Rabban Gamliel to go down the ramp, even if the non-Jew built the ramp right in front of him. So the Gemara now questions these two opinions. The Gemara says, "Meisve, Amar Lohen Rabban Gamliel." The Gemara now questions the opinion of Rava. Because remember, Rava just told us that even if Rabban Gamliel was standing right there when the non-Jew built the ramp, it would still be mutter to go down because he's not going to build the ramp any differently because of the extra people going down. The problem is that in this Brisa, Rabban Gamliel says to his colleagues when he's trying to convince them to go down the ramp, he says, you know why we're allowed to go down this ramp on Shabbos? Because the non-Jew built the ramp, shelo bifaneinu, not in our presence. So the fact that he's saying that the only reason why you're allowed to go down this ramp is because it was built shelo bifaneinu obviously implies that if it was built bifaneinu, if we were standing right here when the non-Jew built it, then it would in fact be a problem to go down the ramp. So this brisa seems to go against Rava, because Rava says, right, again, remember, Rava said it makes no difference if you're physically standing where the non-Jew is when he's building the ramp. All that matters is whether the non-Jew would do anything different when building the ramp. So how does Rava answer this brisa? So the Gemara says, no, Ema ho vilvatso neribo. So Rava basically just took out the words shelo bifaneinu. He just kind of amended the brisa and says, yeah, you're right. We just take out the words shelo bifaneinu, and now the brisa just says that since the non-Jew built it for himself, so therefore that's why we're allowed to go down it. So that's how Rava could still justify the reading of this brisa. Okay. The Gemara now tries again with another proof, this time against both Abaye and Rava. Tashma.
What's the malacha that the non-Jew did? Is it maka?
It's maka bepatish. It's bonez. Again, that's a question from a few prokem ago. How do you differentiate between maka bepatish and bonez?
I mean, if we when you disembark on these boats.
No, it's not right. It's not the disembark. I mean, I guess in theory it could be if you're going from one rishus to another.
Just going ahead and they're making a metal ramp, but they're not really building anything.
Correct. But I think the assumption was in this story the guy was actually physically building a ramp, and that's probably what's happening. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara now says Tashma Irshe Yisrael v'Nachrim Darin Besocha v'Haisa b'Merchatz Hamerachetzes b'Shabes Imrov Nachrim Mutter Lirchotz b'Miad. Imrov Yisrael, Yamtin Bichtesha Yecha Muchanin. The Gemara says the following. Let's say I live in a community that has a mixture of Jews and non-Jews, and I want to go to the bathhouse on Motzei Shabbos. The problem is that I know the bathhouse was used on Shabbos itself. So the question is, okay, so what's the majority population of the community? If the majority are non-Jews, so then it's fine. Then it's permissible to use the bathhouse immediately after Shabbos. Why? Because even though the water was heated on Shabbos, it was clearly heated for the non-Jews, which of course is mutter. It's permissible to heat water for non-Jews on Shabbos. That's okay. On the other hand, if the majority of population of the city is Jewish, so then the Gemara says you cannot go to the bathhouse right away. You have to wait what's called Bichdei Sheyecha Muchamin, which is another way of saying a concept that we spoke about 50 daf ago, an idea called Bichdei Sheyasu. This is an idea the Gemara mentioned back on daf Ayin Aleph, which means that basically that if a person does a malacha on Shabbos, and in this particular case it happens to be a non-Jew doing malacha for a Jew, but the same idea would be true if a Jew, let's say, did a malacha b'shogeg on Shabbos. So for example, let's say a Jew b'shogeg cooked on Shabbos, and now you want to know, am I allowed to eat the food that the Jew cooked b'shogeg on Shabbos? So the Gemara has this idea that you have to wait after Shabbos the amount of time that it would have taken for that food to cook. So let's say it took 20 minutes for the food to cook, you have to wait 20 minutes after Shabbos before eating the food. So it's the same idea here. So let's say it took, 45 minutes to heat up the bathhouse, you have to wait 45 minutes after Shabbos. That's again assuming that the majority population is Jewish. So the majority population is not Jewish, you can go to the bathhouse the second Shabbos is over. But if it's a majority Jewish, you have to wait that amount of time before you're allowed to go to the bathhouse. Now, this Bryce...
It's really a bad demographic example, I think. Because
why?
What happens if we know that it's only the dudes that go to the bathhouse?
Okay, that's a good question. You're saying... What if you have a 51% non-Jewish community, but 75% of the bathhouse attendants are Jewish? Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably the answer is that you follow the majority demographic of people who go to the bathhouse. I think the Gemara couldn't really envision a case where you had a majority of one, but a majority of another in the bathhouse. I think it was just for simplicity's sake was giving a case where things were the same. But I agree that if there was a difference in percentages, then you probably should follow the majority of people who go to the bathhouse. I think that's probably true.
What's
50-50? Oh, okay, we're going to get to that in a second. Hang on one second. We're going to see it in a second. Okay, so again, the question the Gemara is raising here is really a question both against Abaye and against Rava. Why? It's a question against Abaye because remember, Abaye said that it's only going to be mutter to use the ramp in the previous case if the non-Jew built the ramp when shalom b'faneinu, when we weren't around. So here, there are no... In other words, even if the majority population of a city is Jewish, none of the Jews are, like, standing in front of the bathhouse when the guy is heating up the bathhouse. So according to Abaye, even if the majority population of the city is Jewish, it should still be mutter to use the bathhouse right away because there's no Jew standing in front of the bathhouse when it's being heated up. And even according to Rava, right, again, remember, Rava was the one who said that, it makes no difference if you're physically standing here or not. All that matters is, would the non-Jew have done anything different? The answer is probably not because, in other words, it really makes no difference what your demographic is, right? In other words, he's not going to heat the bathhouse up any differently if there are more Jews or non-Jews coming in. It's the same process. So Either way, the Gemara says, this brisa that tells us that if a bathhouse attendant heats up water for a majority Jewish population on Shabbos, that you need to wait those 45 minutes or whatever it is before you can use the bathhouse, that seems to be a problem both according to Abaye and according to Rava. So how do you resolve that? So the Gemara says, you're right, Hasam ki mechamame adaita deruba mechamame. This kind of touches on something that Mitch was alluding to before, which is that the assumption is that the bathhouse attendant probably heated up the water for the majority. How does that answer the question? Because if you know that that the bathhouse attendant heated the water up for the Jews specifically, or for the Jews specifically, then it's going to be problematic no matter what. Because if you know that his intention, his kavana in heating the water up was expressly for the Jews to use the water, so then the assumption is that it's going to be a problematic. In other words, this machlokas between Abaye and Rava about whether you have to be there or whether the non-Jew has to not do anything different, that was assuming if, let's say, for example, you have one Jew and one non-Jew. So everything is, it's kind of 50-50 a little bit. But here, if the overwhelming percentage of people in the community are Jewish, and it's obvious to you that the bathhouse attendant is heating the water up for the Jew, then this whole question becomes a moot point, because it is clear that the bathhouse attendant is doing all this malacha for the Jew. So that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, because it's obvious that he's doing it for the Jew, therefore it's going to be problematic. Again, you're going to have to wait those 45 minutes or whatever it is after Shabbos before you're allowed to use the bathhouse. Okay, the Gemara now tries again. The Gemara says, Tashma, ner hadoluk b'mesiba, imrov nachre mutter lehishtamish l'ora, imrov Yisrael aser, mechtzal mechtza aser. The Gemara says, what if I have the following case? There's a party going on Shabbos. Again, you have a split between Jews and non-Jews, and you have a bunch of candles that were lit at this party, and you want to know, are you permitted to benefit from the light of those candles? So again, it depends. If the majority population of the people at the party is non-Jewish, then the assumption was it was lit for the non-Jews. Therefore, it's going to be mutter. If the majority is Jewish, or even if it's 50-50, like Yaakov was saying before, there we have to be machmir because it's a suffolk, then the assumption is it's going to be a problem. But again, both according to Abaye and according to Rava, it should be problematic. Why? Because even if you have a majority of a Jewish population, that is the halakhic equivalent of the case that we mentioned earlier of makiro. Because if there are Jews at a party, the assumption is that the non-Jews know who they are. They're not just going to walk into a random party of people they don't know. So the fact that, you know, that the Jews are attending this party means that they're friendly somewhat, or at least they know the non-Jews. And the Gemara says that it's still going to be a problem to light the candle for them. So how do we resolve that, with based on what we said before? So the Gemara gives the same answer. Hasam nami ki madlikei adaita deruba madlikei. The same idea that the non-Jew was lighting the candle, al das the majority. So again, whatever the majority is going to determine whether it's permissible to benefit from the light of that candle. And then the Gemara says, Shmuel ikla leveyav in Toran, asa hahunachri adlik shraga, ahadrinu Shmuel ha'ape. So Shmuel one time was at the house of this non-Jew named Avin Toran, and a certain non-Jew in their house lit a candle on Shabbos, and Shmuel turned his face away from the light because he didn't want to benefit from the light. But came on the chaza da'ise shtar v'kakare, and once he saw that the non-Jew brought out a document and started reading the document in front of the candle, Omar, he said, adaita de nafshi hu da'adlik, ahadrinu ihu la'ape gabe shraga. Then he realized that the non-Jew lit the candle for himself because he wanted to read something in front of the candle. And then Shmuel says, okay, now I'm allowed to benefit from the light of the candle. Okay, Hadron Allah Kokistar. Okay, so now, just to give a drop of background really to the next two prakim, the 17th and 18th prakim of Masechta Shabbos are going to go into extraordinary detail about some of the halachos of Hilchos Muktzah. A lot of Hilchos Muktzah that we have are based off of these two prakim, as we'll see. So the Mishnah tells us, Kol akilim nitolin b'Shabbos v'dalso sehen imahen afal pishen esparku she'enon domin l'dalso sabayis l'fi she'enon min amuchan. So the Mishnah starts out with the following halacha. Any type of utensil that exists, again, we'll see some exceptions as we go on to the Gemara, but pretty much any type of utensil is allowed to be carried on Shabbos. Not only the utensil can be carried, but the door that is attached to the utensil, which again we'll see in the Gemara what that means, that can be carried as well, even if it was detached. Why? Because the door of a kli, again, for example, as we'll see in the Gemara, let's say the door of a portable box or a chest or something like that. So that obviously is a kli. It's not karka. It's not attached to the ground. So the Mishnah contrasts a door of a kli, of a movable item, to the door of a house. The door of a house, even if it's physically detached from that a house right now, but it's not min hamuchan, right? No one plans to move the door of a house on Shabbos, right? Usually you think the door of a house is going to be attached to your house. So even if somehow the door of your house gets unhinged, you would not be allowed to move that on Shabbos. That would be muktzah. Whereas the door of a movable item, of a chest, of a box, or something like that, you would be allowed to move on Shabbos because, again, the assumption was that it was set aside to move before Shabbos. Then the Mishnah transitions to another very famous halacha. Notel adam kurnas lefatzeah bo esai goes in. A person can take a hammer or a mallet to use to crack nuts. Kardom lachtuch bo esai devela, a certain kind of a knife to cut this cake of pressed figs. Megira lagurba esai gavina, you can use a saw to cut cheese. Magrefa ligrof bo esai grogros, you can use this kind of like a shovel, basically to scoop out these figs. Then the Mishnah says, es harachas vias hamalgez lasesal of the katan, you could take like a winnowing spoon or a pitchfork to use to give food to a young child. Es hakush vias hakarker lischovbo, these are different threads and needles and shuttles and things that are used in the process of weaving and on the loom. You can use these as basically, you know, essentially like a fork. You can use them to kind of stick into your food to eat with. Machat shel yad litol bo es hakotz, you could take a needle to remove a splinter or a thorn. Vishel sakoyim liftoach bo es hadelas, you can use the needle that was used by professionals who would weave sackcloth to open locks and to pick and you know to pick locks and to open doors. What exactly is the point of this, of all these examples? All the examples in the Mishnah that we just quoted are basically underlying one halacha, which is the concept. It's called a kli shemalachto leiser letzorech gufa. We're going to spend a lot of time in the Gemara in the next few days talking about the details of this halacha. But very basically, for right now, if I have an item where the majority of the time the item is used for a forbidden purpose, like a hammer, like a pitchfork, right? Typically, it's used for malacha. It's used for boned. It's used for zoref or whatever malacha. But I decide I want to use it for a permissible function. I want to use the hammer to crack open nuts. I want to use the pitchfork to feed my child. I want to use the thread on the loom to use as a fork. The Mishnah says that's mutter. What that halacha is known as a kli shemalachto leiser letzorech gufo. If I use a kli where typically it's used for a forbidden purpose, but I decide to use it for a permissible purpose, then it becomes mutter. We'll see in the Gemara, by the way, not everyone agrees to this. Not everyone accepts this halacha. There are some tanaim. What?
Does it have to be designated before Shabbos?
Not necessarily. We'll see in the Gemara. It's going to depend on the type of kli that we're talking about. We'll see as we go on. But again, not just to be honest about this, not all the tanaim accepted this. As we'll see in the Gemara, Rabbi Nechemiah and others disagreed, and they thought that even a kli, even if I'm using it for a permissible purpose, it may still be a problem to use on Shabbos. Again, we'll see that as we go on in the parak. Okay. So the Mishnah now says, I'm sorry. So the Gemara says, Kol akilim nitalin va'afal pishen esparku b'Shabbos v'lo mi. The Gemara makes an inference from the Mishnah. Our Mishnah said that any kli, again, any type of movable item, so we said that not only can I carry that item on Shabbos, but I can carry the door of that item even if the door was removed on Shabbos, and kal v'chomer if the door was removed from before Shabbos. Meaning, for example, let's say I have a chest or a box, and it had a door on it, and the door became unhinged from the box on Friday. So the Gemara says, well, if you're telling me that a door that became unhinged on Shabbos itself, I'm still allowed to carry that door. So then kal v'chomer, if the door became unhinged before Shabbos, I would say for sure it's mutter. Why? Because in that case, the assumption was that you almost specifically set it aside to be able to carry on Shabbos. So the Gemara says, no, that's not true. The Gemara says, adarabba, b'Shabbos muchanin al gabi avien, b'chol in muchanin al gabi avien. The Gemara says, one could argue the exact opposite, that when the door becomes removed from the box or the chest on Shabbos, there at least I can argue that it's mutter to move. Why? Because when Shabbos began, the door was still attached to the box. So at least there you can argue that it's not muktzah because it's part of the kli which is permissible to move on Shabbos. Whereas in a case where the door became detached on Friday, so when Shabbos began, there was no justification for me to be able to carry that door because it wasn't attached to the main body of the kli. So perhaps one could argue that it's actually problematic to carry that on Shabbos. So Amar Abaye Hachi Ka'amar. So Abaye says, Kol akilin nitolin b'Shabbos v'dal soseh ani mohen afal pishin esparku b'chol nitolin b'Shabbos. So Abaye kind of amends the Mishnah a little bit. Abaye says what the Mishnah really should have said was the following, that any kli is allowed to be carried on Shabbos with its door, even though the door was removed on Friday, you're still allowed to carry it on Shabbos. So Abaye kind of reinterprets the Mishnah to mean that no matter when the door was detached from the kli, you would still be permitted to carry that door on Shabbos, even if the door was removed from beforehand. Okay. The Gemara now says, Tana Rabbanan, Deles shel shida v'shel tiva v'shel migdal notlin ava lo machazirin vishel lul shel tarnegolim lo notlin velo machazirin. The Gemara now contrasts the door of a chest or a box or something like that, where the Gemara says in those cases you are allowed to, in other words, you can remove the door from that, from the chest or the box on Shabbos, but you are not allowed to restore it. Whereas when it comes to a chicken coop, the door of a chicken coop, the Gemara says you can neither restore nor remove the door from the chicken coop on Shabbos. So the Gemara explains, Bishlama shel lul shel tarnegolim kasav arkeva demechabre ba'ara yesh binyan bekarka yesh shtira bekarka. I understand the case of the chicken coop, why it's a problem to put the door on and to take the door off, because this opinion in the Gemara is assuming of what's called yesh binyan v'yesh shtira bekarka, which in fact, the whole definition of bona and soser, typically, right, when you hear the term building and building and destroying, most of the time we associate those terms with construction of a building which is attached to the ground, right? Usually when a person builds a utensil, so we don't typically use the terms bona and soser in that context, right? So when it comes to an item which is attached to the ground like a chicken coop, so I understand very well why I'm not allowed to remove the door or attach a door, because that is the definition of bona and soser. That would be a malacha on Shabbos. But the problem is, says the Gemara, Ela shel shida v'shel teva v'shel migdol ma'ika sofer. Ika sofer yesh binyan b'chelim yesh stira b'chelim v'i ain stira b'chelim ain binyan b'chelim. The Gemara says, make up your mind. Meaning, in the case of the chest or the box or whatever, in those cases of the portable utensils, so the Gemara says you have to be consistent. How are you telling me that I'm allowed to remove the door from the chest or the box on Shabbos, but I'm not allowed to restore it? Meaning, either you believe that the concept of bona and soser also applies to kelim as much as it applies to things that are attached to the ground. If that's the case, so then why am I only allowed, in other words, if bona and soser applies equally to kelim, then it should be usher to put the door on and to take the door off. It should be usher to do anything. And if you think that the whole concept of bona and soser do not apply to kelim, then everything should be mutter. Then I should be able to put the door on and take the door off. So how could the Gemara come up with what seems to be this arbitrary distinction and say, oh, in the case of the chest, I'm allowed to take the door off, but I can't put the door back on? In other words, it just seems to be an arbitrary distinction. So the Gemara says, you're right.
Are we taking the door off for destruction purposes? What are we taking the door off?
Well, meaning the assumption is that removing the door is a form of soser. Meaning, that's part of the Gemara's question. If you think that bona and soser applies to kelim like it does to karka, then it should be usher to put the door on or take the door off. If you think that it doesn't apply to kelim, then everything should be mutter. How could it be, in other words, the question is, how could it be mutter to remove the door but not restore it? That's that middle ground opinion seems to make no sense. So the Gemara says, Amar Abaye, la'olam kasavar yesh binyan b'chelim v'yeshtir b'chelim v'shenit luka. Amar Abaye says, you're right. Really, everyone agrees that the malacha of bona and soser apply equally to kelim as they do to karka. So the question, of course, is then why is it mutter to remove the door? So Abai says it's not mutter to remove the door. The case is shenitlu, where you already removed the door. In other words, you already violated the iser. So Abai says, in other words, you're right. Abai says you're really not allowed to remove the door from the chest or the box, but you did it already. So once you did it already, the Gemara teaches you, by the way, don't put it back on. It's not, in other words, the Bais never meant to say that, you know, that you're allowed to remove it. It means if you removed it already, don't put it back on. That's Abai. So Rava says, Amar le Rava, shtei tshuvas, but Rava says, I have two problems with this answer of Abai. Chada, first of all, denotlin katani. First of all, textually, it doesn't read straight, because the Braisa said the word notlin. Notlin sounds like lechadchila, you're allowed to remove the door from the chest to the box. And Abai just, you know, changed the word to shenitlu, which means that you already removed it. So just textually, that first point is difficult. V'od, my avalo machazirin. Also, another textual problem, says the Gemara, says Rava to Abaye, is that why does the Gemara say aval lo machazir? And the word aval seems to be out of place. If Abaye was correct, that the case was where the guy already removed the door, and now we're just telling him, by the way, don't put it back on, the word aval is very misleading, because the word aval, we know, is always a contrast, right? This is mutter, but this is usher, right? Or this is usher, but this is mutter. So, in other words, saying that it's mutter to take the door off, to remove the door, aval lo machazir, but don't put it back on, that clearly implies that the Braisa sounds like it's mutter to, you know, to remove it, but it's usher to put it back. How could Abaye just, you know, kind of arbitrarily, you know, say, oh, by the way, that Braisa never really meant it. That Braisa really meant to say that the guy already took it off. It doesn't sound that way from the Braisa. So the Gemara says, Ela Amar Rava, Kasavar ein binyan bechilim ve'ein stir bechilim, ugzera shema yiska. Rava completely disagrees with Abaye. Rava says that really the malacha of Bona and Soser do not apply to Kalim. So the question, of course, is if that's the case, then why is it a problem to, you know, to restore it, to put the door back on the box or the chest? The Gemara says that was a gzera derabanan because we were afraid that if we let you put the, you know, to restore the door back on the box or the chest, you're gonna implant it too hard in the ground, and it's gonna be a malacha of makah bepatish. You're gonna really forcefully put the door in the ground and put it in a way which is very permanent. So in order to avoid that problem, Rava says the Chazal made a gzera derabanan forbidding you from doing that. Okay. So then we said in the Mishnah, no tel adam kurnas, we said a guy could take his mallet, his hammer, to crack nuts on Shabbos. So Amar Rav Yehuda, kurnas shel egozin lifatzea bo eso egozin, aval shel napachin lo. So comes Rav Yehuda and says that yes, you can take a hammer or a mallet that was set aside to crack nuts on Shabbos, that you can use for cracking nuts, but to take the hammer of a blacksmith to use to crack nuts on Shabbos, according to Rav Yehuda, is a problem. Why? Kasavar dover shemalachto leiser afilu litzorech gufal aser. Because Rav Yehuda fundamentally disagrees with the halacha that we mentioned earlier. Remember, we said that we typically assume that if I have a kli shemalachto liyisr, I have a utensil which is typically used for a forbidden function, but I happen to, but in this particular context, I happen to be using it for a permissible reason. So we usually paskin lahalacha that it's mutter. So the way that we would paskin is that theoretically I could take a blacksmith's hammer and use that to crack open nuts, but Rav Yehuda disagrees with that. Rav Yehuda assumes that you can only use a specific type of hammer that's meant for cracking nuts on Shabbos, but you cannot use a blacksmith's hammer. So the Gemara now pushes back on that. Amar le Rabba Elamayat, if that's the case, Seifa Dikatan Vyasa Rachas Vyasa Malgis Lasesa Lovlakatan Rachas Umalgis Mimi Achtili Lakatan. But the Mishnah also told us that on Shabbos I'm allowed to take a pitchfork or a winnowing spoon and use that to feed my kid. The question is, who on earth uses a pitchfork to feed their kid, right? That's not normal. So according to Rav Yehuda, who just told us that the only time I'm allowed to use a kli on Shabbos is if it's being used, if it was designated for that purpose, who on earth designates a pitchfork to feed their kid with? So how can the Mishnah say that it's mutter for me to take my pitchfork or a winnowing spoon and use that to feed my kid with that? So the Gemara says, you're right, Ela Amar Rabba, kurnas shel napachen lefatzeya boha egozin, kasavar davar shemalachto liyasu letzorah kufa mutter. So comes Rabba, and Rabba disagrees with everything that we just said. Rabba holds that, in fact, you are allowed to take a blacksmith's hammer and use that to crack open nuts, because Rabba holds the way that we paskin lahalacha, which is that a kli shemalachto liyasur, a kli which is typically used for a forbidden function, but if I'm doing it letzorah kufa, if I'm doing it for a mutter purpose, then it's mutter. So Rabba clearly disagrees with Rav Yehuda's premise. Now the Gemara pushes back on that. Isive Abaye l'Rabba, medocha im yesh ba shum metal telinosa v'im lav ein metal telinosa. So comes Abaye according to quote the following Braisa. The Braisa says on Kuch of Dalet, that if I have a basically what's called a mortar and pestle, right, which I use to grind up herbs, so the Braisa makes the following distinction. If there's garlic inside of the mortar and pestle, I'm allowed to carry it, but if there's no garlic inside the mortar and pestle, then it's muktzah, then I'm not allowed to carry it. So again, what's the pshad with that distinction? So for example, we know that the mortar and pestle itself on Shabbos is muktzah, because typically you only use a mortar and pestle to grind things, which is the malacha of tochim, which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Let's say I decide I want to use my mortar and pestle as, I don't know, a chair, a seat. I want to turn it over and sit on it. So the Gemara says that would only be mutter to do if there was actually garlic inside of the pestle, because there, at least you would, you can tell that you already used it for its purpose, and you're not going to use it for the malacha of tochim. So the Gemara says, yes, there are scenarios where you're allowed to carry a mortar and pestle on Shabbos. That's true, but there are no scenario, says the Gemara, where you're allowed to use a mortar and pestle in a permissible way on Shabbos. So Abaye says to Rabba, hang on a second, you just told me that if I have a kli shemalachto liyisr, a kli which is typically used for a forbidden purpose, but I figured out a way to use it in a mutter way, that's mutter. I could take my blacksmith's hammer and crack nuts with that. That's totally fine. The question, though, is, if that's true, says Abaye, how come there's never a scenario where I'm allowed to actually use a mortar and pestle on Shabbos? Forget about carrying the mortar and pestle and using it to sit on. That's the context of the the Gemara on Kuchav Dal. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in actually using it. Let's say I want to take the mortar and pestle and I want to actually use it for something which would technically be permissible, right? Let's, I don't know, let's say I took, instead of crushing up garlic or whatever it is inside of the mortar and pestle, I decided I wanted to take the mortar and pestle and turn it upside down to cover an egg or something, whatever it is, right? In other words, I'm using it for some mutter purpose, right? So the question is, it sounds like from this Gemara that that would still be problematic. Why? Because the only thing that this Gemara allows us to do with the mortar and pestle, if there's garlic in it, is to carry it, but never to use it. So the question is, why not? According to Rabbah, if you really believe that a kli shemalachto liyisr, that a kli which is typically used for usher purposes, but I found a way to use it in a mutter function, that should be mutter. So then Rabbah should be telling us that, you know, forget about carrying the mortar and pestle, I should be allowed to use it for whatever I want. In other words, for any mutter purpose. So the Gemara says, you're right. Amar le hamani Rabbi Nechemyahi to Amar in kli nitel elo tzorach tashmisho. So this is the shita that we alluded to earlier. This brisa is the very machmir opinion of Rabbi Nechemyah. Rabbi Nechemyah has one of the most stringent outlooks when it comes to Hilchos Mukta. He holds that a kli is never allowed to be carried on Shabbos unless you're using it for its specifically intended purpose. This is a very machmir shita. Then, in other words, Rabbi Nechemyah basically holds that the only type of kli that you're allowed to carry on Shabbos, he says, is basically a kli shemalachto leheter, but it's more than that. It's a kli shemalachto leheter that I'm using for its intended purpose. So, in other words, according to Rabbi Nechemyah, I would not be allowed to take a hammer to crack nuts on Shabbos. That would be a problem. Again, unless it was obviously a hammer that was set aside for cracking nuts. But in other words, according to Rabbi Nechemyah, you are never allowed to take a kli and use it for anything other than its expressly intended purpose on Shabbos. So this brisa would seem to conform with the opinion of Rabbi Nechemyah. So the Gemara pushes back on that as well. The Gemara says, "Esive," skipping the parentheses, "v'shavin she'im katzav alav basar she'asur l'taltlo." The brisa says, let's say again, I have my mortar and pestle, and now I wanted to use it to crush up meat, to grind up meat on Shabbos. So the Gemara says that once I've chopped up my meat, so now I am no longer allowed to carry it. So again, the question is, why is that the case? In other words, once I've already crushed up the meat, it should be mutter. Again, in this particular case, we're talking about yantif, right? Because for the purposes of simchas yantif, it should be permissible for me to be able to carry the mortar and pestle and to crush up the meat. So you see from here the fact that this mortar and pestle is a kli shemalachto liyisr, because typically it's used for usher functions like grinding up herbs and things of that nature. So you see that it's going to be problematic to carry this kli. So the Gemara says, you're right. The Gemara says, sovar l'shanuye leke rabbi nechem. So initially, the Gemara wanted to answer that this price also probably follows the very machmir opinion of Rabbi Nechemyah. But came in the Shama Lahad the Amar Rachinana Bar Shlemya Mishmei Derav Hakomodin Besiche Zairei Umezorei the Chavan the Kaper Alai Miyachel Humakom Hakanami Miyachel Humakom. The Gemara says that once we heard the statement of Rachinana, that when it comes to these specific types of these different kinds of kalim, these needles that were used to hold clothing together in the laundry, or these different kinds of presses that were used to iron clothing, or again all these different types of things that were used for weaving, for laundry, those kinds of things, the point is that these types of kalim were unique specialty tools, and most likely the guy who was in charge of doing the laundry or ironing your clothing would not want people using his expensive tools to crack nuts on Shabbos or whatever. In other words, you know, the same way that, you know, for example, a moel would never want you using his mila knife, or a shochet wouldn't want you using his shochet knife to, I don't know, cut your food, because it's going to probably ruin the knife. So it's the same idea. This guy is not going to want you using his needles or whatever for your own purposes on Shabbos. So the Gemara says that's the reason why you're not allowed to use these things, because these items are specialty items. They were set aside for a specific purpose and not for the purpose of what you want to do with it. But a normal item that's not a unique specialty item that just happens to be, let's say, a blacksmith's hammer, but it's not, you know, crazy expensive, or it's not something that the blacksmith particularly cares about, so then in a Hanami, the Gemara says it might actually be mutter to use. And the Gemara just adds one detail here. Itmar, Rabbi Chiya bar Abam, Rabbi Yochanan, kurnas shel zahavim shaninu. According to Rabbi Chiya, we're talking about the mallet or the hammer of a goldsmith. Rav Shemin bar Abba, Amar kurnas shel bisamim shaninu. We're talking about the hammer that was used by people who used to grind up spices. So manda amar de bisamim kol shekein de zahavim. Manda amar shel zahavim aval de bisamim kapet alayu. The Gemara says that if you think that the correct text of the brisa is that you can't use the hammer of for spices, then kal v'chomer, you can't use the hammer of a goldsmith to crack the nuts on Shabbos. If you think that it was just the hammer of a goldsmith, so then when it comes to the hammer for spices, so apparently people were more machmir about that because the hammer for spices had a certain smell. It smelled like the spices. Therefore, the Gemara says that it would be problematic to use that on Shabbos because the guy who's in charge of crushing up spices is not going to want you using his spice hammer to, you know, let's say, for example, to crack nuts on Shabbos.